Welcome to the Gritty Hour. Time to get down to the nitty gritty.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Gritty Hour. I have two special guests today. I have James and Bear, the authors of the New York Times bestseller, Harmonic Wealth, The Secret of Attracting the Life You Want. And now they're back with a new book called The Business of Redemption, The Price of Leadership in Both Life and Business. And we welcome you both, James and Bear, to the Gritty Hour.
Thank you, Thomas.
Thank you for having us.
It's an honor to have you. So tell us a little bit about wherever you want to start, the new book, the old book, wherever you want to go.
Well, why don't we talk a little bit about both of our backstory, because it fits sure. in to both the books, actually. Harmonic Wealth was the salvation of our backstory, and not literally, but the principles that are taught there, and we can address that. And then The Business of Redemption is more of a memoir of what we went through to get back to a place of redemption, which is translated literally as to gain or regain something by paying the price. Mm-hmm. I know we hear the word redemption a lot in religious circles, and we're certainly in alignment with that. And yet the true definition is to gain or regain something by paying the price. And we certainly have done a lot of gaining and regaining and a lot of price paying, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so just a little bit about my backstory, and then Bersaba can tell you hers, is that I rose to the peak of my profession in personal leadership, development, spiritual development arena. And I was on Oprah twice, Larry King twice, a Today Show once a month for multiple months running. You know, I created with my team an Inc. 500 company, one of the fastest growing privately held corporations in the nation, and over a $10 million business. I could go on, but by the definition of worldly success, I was a great example of that. And I really felt like I had reached the top of where I was supposed to be. And it took me a long time to get there, Thomas. You know, I never had an easy life. I worked 20 years to become an overnight sensation. And so I asked God literally back in 2006, thereabouts, to help me have a larger impact and influence in the world. And that was when The Secret came out, and it blew up. If your viewers are reminded of that movie, I was a co-author of that book and also in the movie as well. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, this is what I asked for, and here I am. And little did I know, when I was at the top, at the peak, that it would all be completely and totally gone within a matter of about 90 days.
Wow.
And yeah, the short story is I had an event in Sedona, Arizona, and I had 52 people. It was a very intimate event, small event. I was doing large venues at the time, but that one was up close and personal, and I was working one-on-one with individuals to break through the blocks, the barriers, the limitations internally that we have that keep us from our greatness and keep us from our accomplishments and what we're capable. Well, it was a long week. It was a 5-day retreat. At the end of that, we had an experiential learning opportunity called a sweat lodge. Now, we'd done this event 5 years prior, and every single year, the sweat lodge was kind of the sizzle on the steak. The steak was the work that we had done all week long. And I learned so much about these individuals, nature of the program. What we were doing is going back and looking at childhood trauma and things that we had dealt with in very early life and not dealt with very well because we don't have the tools and the resources. And so consequently, we were working to heal those and integrate those, reframe those and integrate them, and then literally set yourself free so you're no longer a slave of these past perceptions. And so it was an intense week. It was an emotional week, as you might imagine. We worked long hours. We worked hard. And at the end, we had this sweat lodge, which was an experience or learning opportunity for us to experience what psychology calls transference, to be able to transfer all the hard work and effort we put together for the week into an experience or learning environment, which was a sweat lodge that would be difficult. It would be hot. It would be crowded. It would be hard. And everyone was warned of this. And so consequently, that brings up the same kinds of doubts and insecurities that are going to come up when we go home back to our life, our relationships and business. And when we can push through those, then we tell ourselves, hey, if I did that, maybe I can do this. And that was the objective. Well, it was always a highlight, and there was a big celebration afterwards because people went in thinking they couldn't complete it, and they always did. And they came out, and there was a celebration, and there was a big dinner, and there was a debrief, but not in 2009. In 2009, something went horribly wrong. And unfortunately, Thomas, to this day, we don't know specifically what occurred, even though a lot of the medical records state that it was organophosphates, pesticides, that caused three of those people to lose their lives in that lodge.
Ah.
And it broke my heart. It literally broke my heart. Imagine if you've ever lost someone that you love and care about. I'd gotten really close to these people all week long, and we built a bond. They became friends, and they lost their lives in that lodge. Well, instead of looking at the forensics, and this is all public knowledge, the state of Arizona, this was in Sedona where it occurred, the state of Arizona decided to come after me for a crime. And they charged me with manslaughter, which is intentional harm. Now, for any of your viewers or listeners who are entrepreneurs, I ask you, how many nanoseconds would you even consider intentionally harming your clients and thinking you're going to stay in business?
Right.
It's ludicrous. And it blew my mind that they were doing this. And so consequently, the minute that I was charged with manslaughter, my whole life fell apart. It just became shattered.
Right.
I lost my Inc. 500 company. I lost, first and foremost, three people I loved and cared about. And that would have been more than enough, particularly on my watch, and because it was the antithesis of anything I'd ever done and or lived my life for. And so I lost those three friends, and then I lost my Inc. 500 company. I lost my home. I lost my life savings. They charged me with manslaughter. They came at me with a vengeance. And it was kind of 2009. I believe it was a precursor of the weaponization of the justice system, quite frankly, because they offered me a plea bargain, and they said, we'll only give you 5 years if you'll plead guilty. And I said to my lawyer, Luis, you want me to plead guilty to intentional harm? And he said, no, no, no. He said, but that's what they want you to do. And I said, well, I can't do that. That's a lie. It's not true. He said, I know. I thought you would say that. He said, but I'm also bound to tell you that they told me if you don't take this plea, they're going to come at you for 30 years with every single thing they have, and they're going to come hard. Well, you can imagine I swallowed really hard at that point. And then I said, I can't do it. It's just not true. I just can't do it. And so they kept their promise. I went to trial for 4 months, and there were 32 counts of prosecutorial misconduct. This is all public record by the DA. There was suppression of evidence in my favor. They were fined. They had to pay sanctions for suppressing evidence in my favor. And so at the end of the day, after 4 months of this trial, the jury, thank God, couldn't find one shred of evidence for intentional harm, because it just wasn't there.
Right.
It was an accident. It was a horrible accident. And yet the way the legal system works, they bumped it up, I found out later, to manslaughter, because there was a lesser included charge called negligence. And negligence basically says things were overlooked and missed. some things could have been done better. And God, I wish they had been done better. And I wish they hadn't have been missed. And so as the leader, and this feeds into the business of redemption, because this story and my whole story thereafter is in the book, The Business of Redemption. But as a leader, it was my responsibility. It was my event. It was my team. It was my decision to do what we now know to be a dangerous exercise. And as a leader, you don't throw people under the bus. You don't blame your team. You don't blame anything. You shoulder it. And so I went to prison for 2 years. And here's where Harmonic Wealth comes in, because Harmonic Wealth, I wrote with a very aggressive objective. Uh-huh. To redefine the word wealth. Now, let me ask you, Thomas, if someone were to ask you to define wealth, how would you define it?
Personally, a lot of money, health, good health, a lot of money, you know.
Well, at least you added the good health part. Mm-hmm. Most people almost invariably say a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But if you trace the etymology of the word wealth back to its origins, it literally translates as well-being. Not money.
Right.
You know, and I will submit to you that some of the least wealthy people that I've ever worked with and met have a lot of money. They're just not very, they don't have a lot of well-being. Right. They have a lot of money, but they don't have a lot of wealth, I meant to say. And so if I had not, and there's five pillars to harmonic wealth: financial, relational, mental, physical, spiritual. And when all five of those are in harmony, then you're truly wealthy. And I will say to you, if I had not been working diligently on those five pillars prior to life's tsunami hitting me, mm-hmm. it would have drowned me. It would right. have taken me down.
Yeah. I'm just going to share the Amazon page while you're talking about this particular book and the origins of it.
Look, yeah, that's me before. Yeah. Got married and had gray hair.
Yeah.
I'm married now. And that, yeah, that's it. I'm just teasing.
It's all good.
But nonetheless, harmonic wealth is really still a fundamental of every single thing we do. And that's what brought Beersheba, I believe, out of her pit. And she can tell you about that. And the business of redemption has been our uphill climb since we met over 11 years ago. When she met me, Thomas, I was homeless. I was 54 years of age. I was $20 million in debt. Now, that's just 10 years ago in 2013. And so I don't think I was a very attractive prospect for a lot of women, but Beersheba is a very unique woman. And I think a lot of her background, which she can share with you, really prepared her to help support me and pull me back up, even when I felt like maybe I wasn't capable of doing that.
Sure. I'd love to hear Bear's story. Obviously, you saw something in James.
Yeah. You know what I saw was the first time I saw him was he was on stage and he had just gotten out of prison. And I didn't know anything about the backstory then. Because I myself had just gotten recently out of a divorce, and I was living in Belgium at the time, so I had come back to the States trying to start my life over. And when I saw him on stage, he was very raw and real, and what he was talking about, it resonated with me just because I was going through my own thing.
Right.
And later on, I looked him up to see, you know, what incident had occurred, and I thought, well, the man I met, and what you read on Google, Google's not our friend.
No.
Didn't quite match. There was something off there. And I felt like there was an injustice that was done there. So that was one of the main things that pulled me towards him. And we started working together first. So I went to him and I said, let me work for you. And that's how it all started. And the reason why the injustice pulled on my heartstrings was because of my own history. I grew up in Iran. I was born in Iran. And I was born at a time where Iran and Iraq were at war.
Right.
And it was also around the time when the so-called revolution had happened, which was in actuality, it's a devolution of what happened occurred there, and the Islamic Republic had taken over. And because of our religious background and our family, they give a lot of hard time to the Jewish people, Christian people, and the Baha'i people, which is my background.
Right.
And the first time I remember, as soon as they took over, because they sold the idea that, hey, let's take the Shah out because he's a dictator, and what we want to give you guys is a democracy, so you'd be able to vote and elect who you want to be the president. So all the people were for that, and they say, yeah, let's do that. That's what we want. And as soon as they got rid of the Shah and the Ayatollah Khomeini came in, it within hours, they said, okay, from this day forth, all the women have to cover up. They have to wear the hijab. And everyone's going, wait, what? What happened? And the military broke out in the streets. I mean, literally, they couldn't believe it because they thought something like that would be impossible.
At right.
And it wasn't. And it happened. And the first time the military broke into our home and took my father away, threw him in prison. And prison there meant that it was a death sentence. You may not come out. And luckily, he did get out. And when he got out, he said, okay, we can't have a life here for our family. We need to leave. And the way you left there was that you couldn't just, you know, get on a plane and get out of there. You had to escape. You'd find people that smuggled us out of the country.
Oh.
So he said, let me go first. And I'm going to provide a life there in the United States, and I'm going to bring you guys over. So he tried to go the first time, and he got caught, and he got thrown in prison again. And this, my mom was devastated and thought, for sure he's not coming back. And she couldn't, women couldn't have jobs there. She definitely couldn't because of the religious background. So how she would provide for us or be able to get some kind of money was she had cigarettes that she would sell to be able to have a little bit of cash and provide for us.
Three kids, right?
No, there was two of us just then. Two. I think. Yeah, the third one hadn't come yet. So, and during that time, my mom went to go visit my dad in prison for the first time, and she was afraid, rightfully so, given what happened to her. Is when she went to visit him in prison, she was raped by the guards there. And unfortunately, this is so common there than not, is that when my father was away at prison, and this happened to my mom, it also happened to me as a kid in that country. So when my father did come out finally, he made it out again, and we decided to leave together as a family. And we found someone that was able to bring us, and thankfully, this time we made it across the border, and we made it to Pakistan.
Oh.
And
that,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And in Pakistan, that's where we got our asylum to be able to stay, and we had to stay there. We lived there for about a year and a half, almost 2 years, before we were able to get our visas and come to the States. And then from there, it's a long story of getting into bad behaviors and gangs and doing drugs and all that stuff
to suppress the pain.
To suppress the pain because when we came to the States, no one spoke the language. The kids, we didn't speak the language. My parents had to work double shifts from 6 a.m. till 10 p.m. at night. TV pretty much raised us, and given the income level that they had, we lived in not very good neighborhoods. So the proximity of the people that were around were up to no good. So
what state did you have this?
The first, it was California for a very short period of, but most of our time was spent in Arizona, which was
Arizona. Okay.
Glendale. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not a very good area. I'll say that. Not my favorite state.
Or James's.
Yeah, right? How ironic is that? You know? But we've been back several times. Spoke there last year. So.
Well, yeah. How did you two meet initially? Besides, you met him on the stage. Oh, you saw him on the stage initially.
Yeah.
He was given a talk.
Yeah, okay.
She stalked you, okay.
On Facebook.
He likes that story.
I like that. It's true, though. Come on.
Yeah, no, so I reached out to him after I saw him speak, and he happened to remember me because I took a picture with him. And I started working with him, and I took over his doing his social media posts and the graphics, and I handle, you know, all of our AV, and so I do all that back end stuff. And
right.
We worked together for at least three years before we decided perhaps we want to become romantic, you know, a romantic relationship.
Very nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that brought you, that was after the first, the bestseller came. Was the other book a bestseller at the time?
The
Harmonic Wealth is what I'm referring to.
Yeah, that one went gangbusters. That was during the high point of The Secret, and it hit the top of the New York Times bestseller list in the first 5 days of its release.
And, you think it was on the power of the movie? excuse me.
That's okay. Yes, mm-hmm. definitely. It was the power of the movie, which went worldwide and you know, then catapulted the exposure and so on and so forth.
Right.
So definitely that was very instrumental in bringing the message to a much broader worldwide audience.
Right. So now you have a relatively new release, The Business of Redemption, and I'm going to take a guess that your two stories have a lot to do with the formation of this book.
It really does. We've been together now about
11 years.
Going on 12, isn't it? I think.
Is it? Maybe.
Yeah.
I think so.
And it's been challenging. Mm-hmm. And it's been amazing. You know, I was really broken emotionally, mentally when I came out of prison. I was angry. I was disillusioned. During the time I was in prison, there was a period where I was literally angry at God, and I just, you know, couldn't believe that this is what had become of my life. And so I had a lot of healing to do, and Beersheba has really contributed to that immensely. I mean, you know, her love and support has made a huge impact on me, right, putting myself back together. And I put myself back together, but not as rigidly. You know, I'm you know, it's like Humpty Dumpty shell shattered, and now it's put to get back together with tape, you know, because there's still cracks and there's still obviously imperfections. And yet I know I'm a better human being as a result of that. Now, at the same time, Beersheba, what she didn't tell you is you started smoking when you were how old?
Oh, 12.
12 years old. So that's pretty early. That's why she's only 3'5".
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But she's not. She's taller than that, really. But
do you still smoke, Bear? Do you still smoke?
No, I quit. Like, that was my biggest hurdle I had to get over. I'm going on 7 years.
Oh, good for you. God bless you.
He smoked for 24 years.
Yeah.
And so in the midst of me healing and coming back together, I didn't know she smoked. She was really sneaky, which is a little unsettling for me.
I was a professional smoker.
I'm still wondering, you know, what she's hiding from me these days. But nonetheless, we were together for years, literally at least, three, four, five years. And I never knew she smoked. Because
that big wad of cash you save by not smoking makes you look taller.
Oh yeah.
It makes her sit sideways.
There you go. Yeah. But that's good. I'm glad you quit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No, it was huge, and I had no idea if any of your listeners or viewers or smokers, Beersheba has done a lot of research, and supposedly it's right up there with heroin. I mean, as far as quitting.
Second.
Yeah. I smoke now. I've been told it's harder than heroin to quit. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That's
hard. It's very hard.
It was hell. It literally was, because again, what happened is she did the marijuana and she did the alcohol and she did the cigarettes and all that to suppress all this pain from sexual abuse and trauma and all these things that she'd gone through. And the minute you take away that veneer,
well, then you unleash hell.
It all comes up for you.
Yeah.
And you have to deal with it.
Yeah.
And so,
but facing that, Bear, you think that helped you?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
By facing all the things that came. So here's the thing I will say, since you do smoke, you can totally understand and relate, is that you, at the time, I did not think that it would be possible for me to be able to experience a life that didn't have cigarettes attached to it. Meaning there were times that I would stop for a short period, but mm-hmm. then I would think about it all the time. Like there isn't, everything that you do is in sync and in schedule with your smoking. So
right.
you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So it's like, I didn't think it would be possible. What I really wanted was, okay, I want to be able to live a life that thing never even existed to begin with. I just want it gone.
Right.
I don't want to think about it. I don't ever want to, you know, oh, it would be nice to have one here and there. And because of the way that we went and he helped me to go at it, was I went because I learned that the cigarettes were an effect and I went after the cause.
Right.
So we went after it and we worked hard, man. I will not minimize what we did mm-hmm. and what I put him through and what I felt. I mean, there were nights where I was in fetal positions because it was horrible.
Right.
It really is. And then to be here where I am now, after I would say the fifth, sixth year of not smoking, I started like feeling like I'm a normal person again mm-hmm. in all rounds, because I know your body has to reacclimate, right? You have to go through a complete whole change of cycle of you're overeating now, and then you got to change your diet, and then you, okay, maybe I'll start working out really intensely to take the edge off.
Yeah.
And
or drink more alcohol.
Or drink more alcohol to take
right,
the edge
right, right.
off. So
now, there is an insidious psychological attachment, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it's a horrible thing. So I finally have gotten to a point today where I don't have that edge, and I don't ever thinking about, like, I could pick up a cigarette and smoke it, which is, I didn't even think it'd be possible. What is possible?
Right.
If you go after it and you go after the demons that pushed you to even starting in the first place,
mm-hmm.
you can put it aside.
Now, sorry, James. Go ahead.
I was going to say for you, Thomas, and I don't know, I wouldn't think... And you can correct me, because I've only been through it with her to this degree for 5 years. Literally, it was hellacious. It really mm-hmm. was. And she had a hellacious past. So whatever demons she was suppressing
sure.
were big demons, you know.
Right, right. I mean,
she's explained it to you.
Right.
And so for those things to come up and have to feel them and deal mm-hmm. with them is incredibly intense.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to say. While you were facing those demons, did you quit cold turkey? That's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
Did you use any other kind of device besides self-analysis through James's help?
Right. I did quit cold turkey mm-hmm. because I've tried every way. Tried to make it halves, go off it slowly, one here, one there, whatever. And I said, okay, that's it. I'm putting it aside.
Right.
The only thing that I did, I started working out really hard. That mm-hmm. was one of the first things. Then I added, I did start eating things more, and then alcohol. In the beginning, alcohol, not that I drank it all the time, but when I drank it, it was to the point of, I don't want to feel anything. I just want to pass out type
right.
of thing.
Right, right, right.
Horrific. Then I start tapering it down little by little, changing the diet and sticking to the workout routine. And I kept the alcohol to, it was once a week or once every 2 weeks or something like that. And just recently, just 2 years ago, I put the alcohol aside.
I thought it had been 3 years.
Maybe this is the third. I'm not sure.
Neither one of us drink anymore.
Right.
I used to enjoy, I say I enjoy it. I think it was programmed. We've been taught that you go out for a nice dinner and you have a nice glass of wine, you know, Italian dinner and you're living. We don't even do that anymore.
Yeah.
And so I used to do that sporadically. And Bersaba and I did that too, but neither one of us even do that anymore.
Yeah. Right. Well, James and Bear, I think you painted a pretty good backdrop to just tell our listeners how you came to the realization you need to write this next book, The Business of Redemption.
Yes. Well, when I was standing in the barren desert of Arizona in 2013, again, I was 54 years of age. I was homeless. I was alone. I didn't know Bersaba yet. And I was $20 million in debt. And I thought, you know, I've got to redeem myself. And I had to ask myself some really hard questions. You know, what do you want the next phase of your life to be? What are you going to live your life for? And as I started to, go inside and dig deeper, what I realized is going back to the realization of harmonic wealth as well, is that your true wealth is not what you have, Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
Your true wealth is what you're left with when all you have is gone. And so, continue with that line of thinking, I thought, okay, I still have the mental and emotional wealth that I had previously, maybe even more so now, given what I've been through. I still have the spiritual connection to God, the spiritual wealth, maybe even more so given what I've been through. I'm just experiencing a temporary setback financially, relationally, and physically, because
right.
I was in horrible physical condition. I lost 40 pounds I didn't need to lose, had periodontal disease. I was physically a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just experiencing a temporary setback. And I realized that I had what I needed mentally and spiritually to get back up. And so consequently, through that contemplation, I decided to start taking it. And the way you do that, when life kicks you down, you get back up.
Mm-hmm.
You get back up, you know, and the forces of resistance must give way. And I'll talk to your viewers and your listeners today. If you're in a difficult time, which so many people are in the world right now, this is a challenging time, let's face it.
Right.
And if you're one of those individuals, the forces of resistance must give way to he or she who refuses to give up. Mm-hmm. The only time you really lose is when you give up.
Right.
You know, everything else is a learning opportunity. And that may sound Pollyanna, but it's true. It's just absolutely true. And so I learned so much through the crash and burn and the tsunami. And that brought me, I said, hey, I need redemption. I need to gain something that I've lost. I need to regain something that I've lost, which was my health and my finances and relationship wealth. And so how do you do that? You move forward. You take a full responsibility. In the book, I talk about a concept, absolute responsibility for every single thing in your life. Mm-hmm. You don't blame the president or the government or the Democrats or the Republicans or the Congress, you know, the economy, none of those things.
Right.
You know, those have an influence on you. Sure, they do, but they're not responsible. You're responsible. And if you look at the word responsible and dissect it, it's response able. So you are able to respond in the way you choose to respond, because it's not what life deals you that determines your experience. It's how you interpret and choose to experience that
right.
that determines your experience. And so it took me 6 years to write this book. Mm-hmm. And it was a real catharsis. If you know, you read it, it's all about my experience in prison and in solitary confinement for the first mm-hmm. month, right next to death row. And because I guess I was so dangerous, I don't know, but You know, they thought I was going to whip a sweat lodge out of my back pocket or something. I don't know. But they don't talk to you much because you're not a human being. You're a number in that system. You're, quote, property of the state. They remind you of that all the time. And so I talk about all of that, and it was very cathartic to write the book. And it took 6 years because I never thought I'd get it right. It's been edited and re-edited again more times than I can count.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And Beersheba was very instrumental in all of that, too. And as far as, you know, when she says she does all the artwork and the cover work, that's her artwork on the front. And as far as, you know, giving input and support and ideas and all those types of things, very instrumental in all of that.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And Bear, did you try to remind him of certain instances as he was trying to conjure up the writing?
Yes, I actually took him back to Sedona.
Yes, you should tell that story. I talk about it in the book, but this is you should.
I believe it was for your 16th birthday. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Yeah. I planned a surprise trip for him. Mm-hmm. And we went to Sedona, and it was the first time he went back since the incident. And we went to the grounds of where the incident had occurred.
Ah, okay.
Set up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he had his little moment there. And,
emotional breakdown.
Yeah.
So she took your advice on you, James.
Yeah.
Yes. She took me back to, you know, and the Toltec is called recapitulation. And that's a mm-hmm. big part of work that both of us do with our clients now, is going back and revisiting the event and yet finding new learnings because you're coming from a different perspective. Psychology tells us if you go back and visit a memory from a different perspective, you can never again think of that the same way. Mm-hmm. You literally can't. And I have so many references for that, as does Beersheba. But it was very emotional, incredibly emotional.
It was to have a little bit of peace because, I mean, it was a tragic accident for the families.
Right, right.
That was involved. And he has to sleep with the fact that three people died on his watch. And he mm-hmm. was there and he saw it. And I know all the details. So it was good for him to go and say goodbye to them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just if I could clear up one thing that you said earlier, James, you said you thought it was when this happened to you originally, you thought it was the early part of the Justice Department politicizing, becoming political. Let me just ask you this. What made you think, why do you think they came at you so hard?
Well, first of all, it was the Justice Department for this case was in Prescott, Arizona. Mm-hmm. Prescott, Arizona is literally a cowboy town, very, very, very small. Mm-hmm. And it was the biggest thing that had ever hit the news. And it went, you know, the media, if any of your viewers or listeners can remember back to 2009, 2010, the media, who once loved me and could not get enough of me, instantly flipped and started literally crucified me. They
right.
called me every single thing in the book, from a cult leader to a murderer to a Jim Jones. I mean, all kinds of things, which were just heartbreaking. And
right.
and so now you've got this small town DA who said, hey, this is good publicity. And you know, I'm an elected official, so let's play on this, quite frankly. And so it was the biggest thing. They asked for a $5 million bail, which had never, no bail. My lawyers first told me when I went to jail, when I was indicted and first put in jail, he said, your bail will probably be $25,000. And then he came back with $5 million. Well, you know, this is back in 2009-10, and if you remember, reflect back, that's when the real estate market tanked.
Right.
You know, the economy was really in bad shape. Mm-hmm. And the way you have to, whatever you put up for bail, you don't get it back.
Mm-hmm.
And And so consequently, my home in Beverly Hills debt was worth $5 million. I instantly couldn't get a loan against it. And I ended up, I couldn't even short sell it for $2 million rather. And so everything was going in down the drain. Mm-hmm. And they were hell bent, like I said, to play this to the hilt. And that's why they said, hey, we're going to come after you with both guns blazing. And my lawyer, Dr. Ian Pace from Harvard, who testified under oath, went through 4,000 pages of medical evidence. And in the doctor's own handwriting in the ER, it says in the admission form, check for toxins, because the people were foaming at the mouth and their pupils were dilated. Well, the state's whole case was heat. I made it too hot. Well, foaming at the mouth and dilated pupils are not indicative of heat. Mm-hmm. Those are not indicators of heat. And by the way, no one had a thermometer. In trial, they said he let it soar to over 225 degrees. How do you know that? You weren't there and there was no thermometer. And by the way, I was in there too. And so it just, it was just really the politicalization, the weaponization of the so-called justice system. And what I've learned, Thomas, and we see indicators of it in the world right now, is that it's not really a search for truth. Our justice system, unfortunately, has become driven by political power and greed.
Right.
And so, you know, I believe God, and this is going to sound maybe unusual to some of your listeners or viewers, but I really believe God had me go through that for me. I can't speak to the people who died or their families, and my heart goes out to them, and it just breaks my heart. And yet for me, he helped me go through that to be prepared for what we're facing in our world right now. And what better way to help people who are hurting than to actually have hurt and hurt hard and experience, right, experience those things? Because I'm not talking from a book report or book knowledge. I'm talking from experience.
Right. So other folks that were in that retreat, I don't want to say survivors, but other folks that were part of that, do you still keep in touch with them?
No.
No.
The fallout was horrendous. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, go back to 2009, 2010, and I was a product of this as well, is we didn't have alternative media.
Right.
Like podcasts. We didn't have X. Mm-hmm. We didn't have, you know, all those other platforms.
Right.
And so I grew up in this country. If the media tells you something, it's credible. And it's probably true. That was mm-hmm. what I believed. Now, Beersheba has a different history, so it's easier for her to understand that is not true. I understand it now.
Right.
But at the time, a lot of those people, and it's really interesting to see human nature, Thomas, because people who literally just a month or 6 weeks prior were telling me how much they loved me and how much I'd helped them change their life,
right,
turned on me. And every single person, and this is unfortunate, you know, I know every single big name in the personal development industry, all of them. Mm-hmm. Would name the name, and not one of them even reached out to say, how are you doing? You know, and just months prior, oh, they had clamored to share the stage with me or to join mm-hmm. venture with me or to be associated with me, and they disappeared. They just disappeared.
Right. And
so, you know, with the exception of Bob Proctor, God rest his soul, who was one of my really early mentors, he stayed by my side and believed in me, which God bless him. And Rhonda Byrne, who was the producer of The Secret, mm-hmm. also believed in me. And mm-hmm. and so other than that, no one. And so I was really jaded. I came back and I said, I do not want to be part of the personal development industry. It's hypocritical. It's nothing I want to be associated with.
Right.
And I still don't like to be called a motivational speaker or personal development, although it's kind of hard to, people sometimes have a hard time categorizing me otherwise. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, that's just semantics.
Yeah. Well, God did give you a bear in the interim.
Well, yes, and I wouldn't trade a bit of it.
Yeah.
I would trade that three people died.
Yeah.
I really wish that didn't happen with all my heart. And yet, I wouldn't trade going to prison.
Right.
You know, I would have never, if I hadn't gone to prison and lost everything externally, I wouldn't have been driven so deeply internally.
Right, and right.
I wouldn't have developed that strength and that ability that I believe I had today. And I'm a much more compassionate and much more loving and much more understanding human being. And I have to attribute a lot of that to a large portion of it, because when she was going through her detox, if you will, in her hell, there was a lot of times when I was like, I can't do this.
Yeah.
Is this, I just can't do this. It's hellacious and I can't do this. And then I'd think, no, she was there for me. I'm going to be there for her. I love her and I'm going to support her no matter what.
Right.
And I'm really grateful that I did, because it's totally turned a corner now.
It's a sweet story. And I would last, before I let you both go, what do you think people will get out of The Business of Redemption after they purchase your book?
Well, my intention in writing it was to say, hey, let me lay it all out. And there's a lot more to the story than what we've had time to discuss.
Sure, of course, yeah.
But so I really lay it out in The Business of Redemption, and then let me lay it all out very clearly. And hopefully the reader, and if you read the reviews are really good on the book on Amazon, which you showed.
Right.
And it seems like I hit the mark. I thought if the reader would read it, they'd go, oh my God, if he can go through that, I can get through this.
Right.
Whatever this is, because I had 7 foreclosures, you know, I mean, we've had 3 banks shut our bank accounts down. There's just so many things that go on when you become no longer the person, or when you become the person with the scarlet letter and they decide to come after you. It's really difficult.
Well, just the financial difficulties. There's millions of people that are in that boat to one degree or another anyway.
That's right.
And how they react to it, they might be helped by reading your book.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yes, and I would say to you, as a viewer and listener, is that no matter where you are today, you can come back and even move beyond. You have this incredible God-given capability, and when you access that and you remember that, and you allow that to work through you versus from you, big difference.
Right,
you know, when you're doing it right, it's coming through you, not coming from you. Then you will win. You will succeed. Yeah. And you may not be a millionaire, a billionaire. You know, not everyone is cut out to be that.
It's not fun anyway. It's,
no, right, right.
Yeah, that's a whole nother story.
Yeah, right, right, right.
When I was worth north of $20 million, it wasn't as exciting as everybody thinks.
Not glamorous.
I understand that, yeah.
Yeah, it's not that glamorous.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, wherever you are today, take heart and keep the faith.
Yes.
Because we're going through massive transition in our world, and people are waking up. And they're starting, you know, I was asleep prior to 2009 and just kind of running on autopilot and going through social conditioning and pursuing the things that social conditioning told me to pursue.
Right.
And so now we choose our own values. We choose our own objectives, our own morals. Sure. And that's our measurement. It's not the external that once was. And so there's light at the end of the tunnel, and you have to continue to push forward, even when you don't see the light. And that's the tough part.
Right. I understand. And that's a great takeaway for our viewers and listeners. I do appreciate James and Bear being on the show. Again, that's the author of Harmonic Wealth, The Secret of Attracting the Life You Want. And that is a New York Times bestseller. And their new book, The Business of Redemption, The Price of Leadership in Both Life and Business. And I highly recommend you give it a listen. Actually, you had mentioned before we started recording, one of those two might be available for our viewers and listeners.
Yes, you can go to harmonicwealthglobal.com/book.
I see. Okay, perfect. And actually, let me write that down because I want to put it in the show notes. Can you run it?
Sure. It's harmonicwealthglobal.com/book.
Book. Okay. That'll be in the show notes for the folks that are watching and listening. And we certainly do appreciate you both being on the show, James and Bear. And I'm sure something will be coming up the road, and we'd love to have you back to discuss that.
Oh, thank you.
We would love to do that. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on the Gritty Hour. We appreciate it.
God bless.